Well, I'll see.
Okay, good afternoon. I'll call to order the meeting of the State Government Budget Division for Wednesday, February 27, 2008. Sorry for the bit of a delay. It's getting to the very busy time of the session here, and there's a lot of competing meetings going on as we speak. But obviously, we got to get our work done here as well, too. We've got two items on the agenda today. We're going to be hearing from the Office of Enterprise Technology and also from the Department of Revenue. So we first have the Office of Enterprise Technology. Mr. Kana, I see you're here, and welcome back to the Budget Division.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Gopal Kana. I'm the State CIO, Office of Enterprise Technology. Mr. Chairman, Senator Olsen, the other members are not here, but I say thank you so very much for your interest in how we manage information technology at the state of Minnesota, and thank you for inviting me here to give you an update. As citizens, Mr. Chairman, we are all getting used to the digital world that allows us to bank, buy goods and services, and conduct business online. We are all more connected now than at any other time in our lifetime. We get information faster, more accurately, and more directly, anytime, anywhere. As Chief Information Officer of the state, my job is to meet that same standard and expectation for government. It is my task to ensure that the technology systems that manage our information work well, and that you and other citizens get the information and the service you need when, how, and where you need it. This requires having a clear plan and direction for effective information management and making the most of resources available to us. In short, my job is to build an information technology infrastructure that is secure, sustainable, and delivers the results our citizens need and expect. Mr. Chairman, I'm proud of my team and cross-agency collaboration that has made our successes possible this past year, and I'm pleased to report to you, sir, that at every level of state government, within agency systems, with the legislature, and with local units of government, the commitment to improve the core government operations infrastructure through use of information technology and superior stewardship is clearly evident. In large part, thanks go to you, Mr. Chairman, and your fellow members of the legislature. This past year, I've had the honor of working with strong bipartisan leadership to think creatively about how we manage and invest in information technology solutions, which are becoming key enablers to the successful functioning of government. Your support has been fundamental to our ability to make huge strides in the entire management process, as well as in mission-critical initiatives currently underway. Of course, we are not done. Actually, Mr. Chairman, in this digital age, as an enabler of government, our technology must continually be enhanced and leveraged to make government better. And the challenges to doing so will continue to mount. Not only are today's resources stretched, as you're so painfully aware, the existing funding mechanisms themselves make difficult the kind of major investment the state will need on an ongoing basis in order to keep our technology systems functioning, responsive, safe, secure, and effective. However, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm eternally grateful to you for your support and the support that you've given us and for your encouragement to be innovative, collaborative, and unrelenting in bringing our state and its services into the 21st century. I am now, sir, with your permission, going to turn over the microphone over to members of my senior staff to provide you updates on several programs and issues that have been of particular interest to this committee. To my right is my associate, John Lally, Director of Portfolio Management and Strategic Planning, and to my left is Chris Busey, the Chief Information Security Officer for the state of Minnesota.
John.
And Mr. Lally, welcome back to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
My name is John Lally, and I'm Planning Director for the Office of Enterprise Technology. Mr. Chairman and members, I'm going to be talking from a handout, which I believe you have, a very brief handout. It's an old Jerry Reed song, "We Got a Long Ways to Go and a Short Time to Get There." I know you've got a lot of items here that want to talk about. With your permission, I'll go at a very high level and summarize the key points for each one, and then if you have questions and want to drill down deeper into that, we certainly can. We're going to talk about two studies that were directed by the legislature last year. Then Chris is going to talk about enterprise security progress. We're going to talk about e-licensing, a little bit about the small agency assistance program that was set up with funding provided last budget session. And then I believe you have some questions about the information and telecommunications account. So that's going to be the first item is the funding alternative study, and I noticed there are copies here. Looks like this with the stripes if you have it in your packet. And this was done at the request of Senator Betzold and Representative Kahn. This is not the first time a study has been done on alternative funding mechanisms. Jerry Meckling from Harvard did one a few years ago, and NASTIO also did one. Our goal was not to replicate what they did, but rather to learn from the body of knowledge that's already out there, but then to apply it to Minnesota's systems and processes and issues and try to come up with some recommendations on how we can improve the process of funding IT in state government. There's a lot of reasons why we have to do that. We face some significant challenges in Minnesota and elsewhere with our technologies. Many of them are becoming obsolescent. They face new challenges as we expect new demands to be met through information technology. And the fact is that there's not enough in the way of resources to accomplish what needs to be done. So we have to look to ways to consolidate our efforts, to find ways to work together, to do a better job of managing the technology portfolio as a whole. Replacing systems, working with 11 electronic government services, and all of these things demand that we think as an enterprise rather than as individual entities within that enterprise. So we're trying to come up with ways here to lead the discussion into what does the enterprise need and how can it best be funded. Traditionally, as you certainly are aware, most of the technology is funded in one of three ways: through the direct appropriation process for creating a new system, through the imposition of fees that are based on volume or consumption or capacity or use. We contract with most of the agencies of state government and with other entities as well for things like network support and storage and hosting capabilities and so on, and they pay us and we deliver the agreed-upon services at the agreed-upon service level. The third is through internal funding. And by internal funding, that's savings captured or money that is set aside in the agency budgets, usually for planning purposes when it comes time to retire a new system. All of those traditional methods help, but there are other things besides that, and that's what the purpose of this study was, to explore those and find ways that we can react more quickly that come up. What I'm going to tell you isn't going to suggest a large pool of money that nobody's noticed. We're not going to suggest there's a whole lot more money in the system, and we're not going to suggest any outlandish methods like routine investment in the Irish sweepstakes as a way of coming up with IT funding. These are all pretty mainline operations that we can use and that are used successfully in other states, and we're simply suggesting that as we go through the analysis that precedes the approval of a new system or the operation of a system, we consider what's the best business model for seeing that funding cycle is properly maintained. In our study, we analyze a group of funding options that are listed on page 3, slide 5. And you will hear many variations on these in the reports. In fact, there's an almost unlimited array of variations that can be imagined from these, but these encapsulate, I think, the major issues. Not only appropriation and fee-based funding and internal funding, the concept of an investment fund, where money that is collected through savings or reallocation can be deposited, invested for future use in the system. The fund we're going to talk about later is a beginning to that, but we're also talking ways to get seed money into the system to help with planning and design of new systems in the life cycle. Vendor participation takes many different forms. It can be as simple as, or simple, perhaps not the right term to use. It can be something like benefits sharing, where a vendor develops a system and reaps part of the benefits from increased efficiency. It can be through vendor financing, where instead of looking to the traditional mechanisms, you borrow money from the vendor to create the system. There are other variations on that. They have the common factor of being more expensive than traditional appropriations in most cases, but in some situations where you have to have a system and you don't have the money, that extra cost may be justified. And that's where the business case comes in, doing that kind of analysis. Bonding has been an issue. We looked very hard at the issue of general obligation bonding to see if full faith and credit bonding is permitted for software. It always seems like if you can bond for a $5 million building, you ought to be able to bond for a $50 million system that runs in that building. But in fact, the language of the Constitution does not suggest that's feasible. Now, I know there's discussions that have taken place about reinterpreting that in statute. I'm not a bond attorney. I don't know how successful that will be. But the discussion has not typically included other types of bonds, particularly revenue bonds, where the revenue stream associated with the new system, whether it's in fees or collections of some sort, can be used to repay the bonds that are used to create the system. So bonding is an alternative, and in some states, particularly Massachusetts, I believe, geo-bonding is used for systems. That doesn't address the issue of whether the bond market will respond positively to the idea of bonding for something like an intellectual asset. Normally, they want something a little harder if they're going to use that in the bonding process. User fees are already used in the state. They are primarily from things like license fees to pay for the operation of the licensing activities. There are other areas that could also use user fees. So that was one of the things we addressed in our study. The concept of lease or lease purchase right now is subject to constraints because the amount of lease that you can do, both the total amount and the percentage of it that can be an intellectual property, is limited by law, but laws can be changed. Again, there's an additional cost to doing it that way. No free lunch here. And finally, outsourcing, and I want to emphasize that when we use the phrase outsourcing, we considered using the word insourcing and right sourcing and all the other kind of euphemisms for it. It does not necessarily mean outsourcing to a private sector entity, a company, to run your systems. In our concept when we did the study, outsourcing could be another government entity within the state. It could be to another level of government, or it could be to another state entirely. Many successful examples of that within Minnesota and among the states of sharing resources for mutual advantage. So those are the options that we analyzed and tried to identify where they would best fit in the funding cycle. The diagram that's on, I guess it's unnumbered slide 6 on page 3, tries to address the three critical components of this. There's a lot more to a system than just creating it. Once you've designed it and implemented it, you have to operate it, and then you have to plan for its eventual retirement. The application system's life cycle, and this would be for a typical application, has a major life cycle cost up front, the expenditure to create the system. Then the costs, absent any other change, drops off once it's implemented because you're basically into a maintenance mode. And then as you approach end of life, those costs increase because with obsolescence comes increased operating and support costs. The benefits, on the other hand, have just the opposite curve, as you see on here. There are relatively few benefits to a system that isn't fully implemented. But the benefits really show up when the system is fully implemented and successfully running. But then again, at the end of life of the system, those benefits drop off as the system loses its efficiency. Now, I'd like you to envision this as a moving target. This system life cycle changes every time you make a change to the system. So, for example, if you create a system, you bring it up, and the next year there are major changes because in our environment there are law changes or federal regulatory changes. it doesn't just not cost more money on the downside of that slope. You just move the slope over because you have a new development cycle that you have to accommodate. And from an operational standpoint, a typical organization like ours or any of the major agencies will have multiple systems at multiple points in the life cycle. And so it's not quite as simple as this diagram illustrates because you have so much happening simultaneously. The next page, titled System Lifecycle Cost Profile, is gathered from a variety of different sources, and it shows the range of costs that are associated with that life cycle. Typically, the planning and assessment and pre-design part of the project occupies 5 to 15% of the total cost of the system. So if you're talking a $10 million system, obviously you're talking somewhere between $500,000 and $1.5 million for the planning phase of it. This is why it becomes such an issue when agencies come to you. If they don't have the money up front to do that detailed planning, they can't give you the assurances that you need about what the final design will cost or what the implementation will be like. Same with detailed design development, the infrastructure pieces, and the testing and so on. There's a different profile depending on what kind of system it is. But those are general ranges of figures that may be helpful. The important one is the circled one at the bottom. Cost doesn't end with implementation. Typically, the system maintenance and operating costs for a computer system, a complex system in our environment, is 25 to 35% of the initial development cost. That's year after year after year. Some of that is in the maintenance cost for things like the operating system and network connections and the application database, logic, all the pieces that are part of it that have to be updated regularly. Part of it is if there are changes made. If the legislature, for example, decides to make a fairly minor change in the application that this program supports, your costs are going to be more for that kind of maintenance. That's why for many agencies, owning a system is a mixed blessing. Once you have it in place, you have to support it. It's a little like your kids. You can't stop feeding them just because the grocery bill goes up. So that profile, again, isn't for any specific system, but it is more indicative of the kind of cost profile that systems in general encounter. The last page, page on slide 4, is a grid where we tried to match up where in the life cycle each of those methods of funding seems most appropriate. The one thing I want to emphasize is that part of the planning process has to be a business case analysis where you really look at what is the likely cost and benefits, how are they going to interact over time, how are you going to support the system. And at that point, then, you do the analysis, what is the appropriate or most appropriate method to use to fund that portion of the life cycle. It would not, for example, be ever appropriate to use bonding for the funding a mature system because you're paying a lot more than you need to in the bond costs for the operating costs. A rate-based system isn't much good for developing a new system because you don't get the money until the system goes into effect. So that lag time means you can't really depend upon it by itself as a funding source. But in concert, you might use one funding mechanism such as appropriation for the design and development, use a fee-based system for it to cover the operating costs, and an internal funding to cover the retirement and planning for replacement. So this is not a perfect grid, but I think the concept that there is not one perfect solution or that any one system should be dependent upon one solution is what we're trying to get across with that. Again, I'm not holding out the hope that there's going to be a lot of free money in this. Minnesota is one of the states that's trying very hard to take a more analytical approach to how we fund systems. As Paul mentioned earlier, we're seeing some other states and other entities trying to mirror that as well. And it's an important topic because there's no simple method for making this happen. The next page has a table of states utilizing various funding options. And I bring this forward with some hesitation because the accuracy of the table is a little suspect. We've found, I know this will surprise you, that if you ask different people in the state different questions, they don't always give you the same answer. So when we talk to the finance departments in the state, we talk to the CIO's office in the state, or we talk to line departments in the state, they sometimes have a different perception of how often these funding options are used. But in general, it, I think, conveys the idea that there are states using all of these methods to one extent or another successfully. And that's, I hope, is the message you draw from that table. That table is from the funding study itself.
And Mr. Lally, I mean, you mentioned the dispute over the use of bonding for technology, and bond counsel are usually not known for being creative. I mean, they're very sticklers down to the commas and the period. So I'm assuming the other states don't have either have different constitutional provisions or different interpretations than we have here. Have you been able to determine why some states feel it's okay to do it and we're not so sure if we can?
It does, Mr. Chairman, have primarily to do what's in their constitution or what is not in their constitution.
Okay.
As you said, bond counsel is notoriously, or historically, maybe is a nicer word to use, conservative in their interpretations. But the bond markets rely on those bond counsel's opinions.
Yeah.
As we went through this discussion, and I might add, the discussion we had included legislative staff, finance people, as well as OET staff in looking at this. We can't say it isn't possible to change statute and have the impact of allowing bonding, but we're also not confident that that is enough. And when we started doing the analysis of it, it occurred to us that there's another issue, which is, if would we rather have systems competing with the overall general fund budget, or the overall state budget, or with a finite and very limited bonding budget when it comes to GL bonds? Revenue bonds, again, are a different case. So our conclusion was inconclusive. We don't think GO bonds are going to be easily used. On the other hand, they're probably not the best solution, but the revenue bonds might be a better thing to consider.
Thanks. Keep going.
Any other questions about the funding study? Okay, the second study that we were asked to put together was electronic document management. And as I was reflecting on this, if you're of my generation, although most of you are younger than I am, you recall the trauma of going from LPs to 8-track tapes to cassettes to CD-ROMs to now electric downloads of music and trying to keep up with changes in the market and ending up with, in my case, reel-to-reel tapes and nothing to do with them. That's the same kind of thing that's happening in technology markets as it applies to software. The market moves at its own pace, and the question is, do we want to chase the market, or do we want to reflect the lowest common denominator of the market? This particular question came up because essentially of a market-driven dispute between people that support different sets of competing standards and, of course, their natural marketing desire to have those be the exclusive standards. But in point of fact, when we looked at this study, we didn't look at the technical merits of any of the individual competing standards. And if you look at the cover of this report, if you have the report in front of you, this lists some of the hundreds of competing standards that exist out there. Some of them highly specialized, others general standards that could use. We don't want to have the unintended consequence of, by prematurely adopting a standard, freezing out part of the citizens or the businesses that we do or the other levels of government by saying to them, you have to update to the latest software that will support this standard or we won't do business with you. So our take on this study was we ought to look at what's in the best interest of the citizens of Minnesota and state government in terms of the ability to access information, to have it efficiently managed so that we don't incur significant costs of conversion of data, and not to be trying to pick winners and losers in the market. And that was the genesis behind our study. Our conclusions on slide 10, electronic information is a critical asset. Absolutely. It's the product of what we do. It's the source of much of the information we use. It captures increasingly the record of what state government does. I used to have 5 file drawers of stuff, just stuff, paper. Now I have 1 because it's all stored on my hard drive or actually on the server. And that's typical of what's happening. We've done some studies of the document storage capabilities, and we find that there's absolutely no question with the massive expansion of the exchange of information, there's no way we could keep up to it without doing electronic records. On the other hand, although that technology is one of the solutions to the problems of managing information, the incompatibility of the various kinds of standards creates problems. Someplace in South St. Paul, public schools are using my old Apple IIe with WordStar. I can't read the data files I created on that old Apple IIe, nor can I read the files I created in Multimate back in the 80s, nor can I read the ones I created in old versions of WordPerfect. Now I use Microsoft Word and OpenOffice on two different PCs in my house. I have incompatibilities even within those particular releases, and that's a problem for all of us to manage. But if I was simply to change over to one standard, I'm going to have problems with all of my old files, plus exchanging information with the different people I interact with electronically. And you multiply that 1,000-fold, maybe 20,000-fold for state government, it gives you an idea of the magnitude of the problem. We've worked a lot in working on this study with other states, with California and New York, among others, Massachusetts, trying to find out where should we go, and we all are independently coming to the same conclusion. Standards are great as long as you aren't so wedded to them that you compromise the efficiency and the impact and the access to information. They should serve you rather than controlling you. And that's the position that we've taken in our conclusions on this study. No matter what we do, we're going to be a multi-standard state. There are too many applications that have highly specialized that simply adopting one or another of the Office format standards will not resolve. And as the boundaries between these applications change, the ability to move information from one application to another becomes far more common, complicating those sorts of issues for us. Most importantly, we found that the electronic markets suggest standards are the solution. In fact, they are only a very small piece of records management and information management in the state. The issue of what we should save, how we should save it, how do we control access for protected information while guaranteeing access to public information is a far bigger issue than the format in which an electronic record is kept. And so our recommendations, in the past we've been essentially observers in the national standards debate, not just around office products but around other things. We think we have to get our information architects more actively involved in those discussions, and we think legislative staff also ought to be more involved in that because it has a huge impact on citizens. We think we need to find a way to pull together the varying definitions of data, information, and documents and treat them consistently for multiple purposes, and that's no small effort to undertake. But we suggest that process ought to begin after the session. And we wanted to also encourage you in the strongest way not to write specific technologies into statute. It's hard to get them out once you get them in. And to give you one example, LaserDisc storage for records was in statute a long time after LaserDiscs were a commercially feasible solution. So the study looked at how do we use information in the most effective ways and manage it in the most effective manner? And we came to these conclusions. And so those are our recommendations to you.
I have a couple questions on that one. I actually carried the bill last year on this, and it was converted into the study. And I've often pointed out to people, I said, we can actually, the documents exist that Lincoln held in his hands as he was making decisions during the Civil War. Yet we can't read punch cards and tapes and diskettes and floppy disks that were generated 10, 20 years ago. And we're making CD-ROMs today that they may not be able to interpret 10, 15 years from now, just as you indicated, Mr. Lally, on the Apple computer. So, how will future generations be able to understand some of our archives if we are not able to keep them? And we can't wait for technology to slow down or stop, because it won't. I certainly agree we can't choose a winner or loser. I mean, if we picked high def and found out everybody else went Blu-ray, that doesn't work for us. But I do recall that Microsoft just the other day made some announcement that they're going to make a lot of their codes and so forth more available for access, and that this obviously announcement was made after the study came out. Does that give us any hint of how things might be proceeding in the future so that we can retain some of the history we're trying to keep?
The battle that's going on right now is a battle for the future. It really doesn't help us with the existing documents. The International Standards Organization, or ISO, is kind of the moderating body on all these international standards. They'd adopted something called Open Document Format, or ODF, as an international standard. Microsoft is trying, obviously, to position their documents, which are also XML-based, like ODF. XML means extensible markup language, in case you're into that. But it's not quite the same, so they don't exactly coincide. But they're trying to create an international standard around that. Now, part of what is involved with an international standard is a definition of it as an open document, an open mechanism that is available to all the competitors, so you don't lock out the rest of the market by embracing a proprietary standard or a standard that can only be implemented through proprietary means. And a lot of what we consider open standards are really proprietary. If you have ever looked at a picture on your computer, it was probably a JPEG. A JPEG is a proprietary standard that everybody uses. If you use Adobe Reader, you're reading ODF. But open documents were created as proprietary standards, although I think they've been released into the public domain now. What we would suggest is when ISO and ANSI, the American equivalent of it that is part of that international organization, agree upon an international standard, at that point we should look to, at a point in the future, saying we will only embrace documents that are created in this standard, which will give citizens, give state agencies, give our business partners an opportunity to migrate to an updated or replacement package without forcing the economic costs of replacing an Office package that will support that standard. Because retrofitting the standard is not something everybody could do. I just had to go through that on my Macintosh at home. And I'm fairly proficient with computers, fortunately, and I was able to do it. But our church secretary, I promise you, doesn't take quite as sanguine a view of the whole process as I do. So we think when the standards are set and they're agreed to by an international organization as open standards, at that point it might be appropriate for us to set a date in the indeterminate future where any purchases the state makes of software must support that, and at that point any documents that we generate or accept would also have to be in accord with that standard. But we would not ever suggest that we go back and convert our existing documents to that standard. The cost of that would be outrageous. Texas estimated $55 million to convert their documents.
And you're correct. It just means that there may be a whole generation or so of documents that, you know, will never be able to be converted or read or whatever in the future because we just, you know, they were created under some format that is going to go by the wayside. But I guess that's a progress.
Chairman, your example of the Gettysburg Address, for example, is a good one, except try to have 48,000 people read the Gettysburg Address simultaneously off one piece of paper, and it gets a little difficult. Mm-hmm. And I think back to my term of service with the military, there was a fire at St. Louis that burned up a lot of the paper records, which were the only record of service for an awful lot of people in the military. Paper has its problems, too. There's no easy solution here. So our movement towards standards is prudent and is appropriate, but it's not going to be the easy solution we all wish it would be.
I think some of my files went up in smoke that day, too. So. Yep. Any other questions on this topic? Okay.
Next topic on the agenda, you asked for an update on the state of security, and I'm going to turn it over to the state's Chief Information Security Officer, Chris Boozy.
Well, Mr. Boozy, welcome back to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, for the record, committee members, my name is Christopher Boozy. I'm the Chief Information Security Officer for the state of Minnesota. I'd like to start by thanking you once again for giving us the opportunity to testify today, and also for the help that you gave us last legislative session, providing us with some of the seed money to get the program up and running. I certainly recognize the tough fiscal challenges that you face as a committee, and we really did appreciate the help. And today I want to show you some of the things that we've done with the assistance that you've provided us. I thought I'd start off today by providing a little consistency with some of the former presentations that we've done for this body and start off with giving you kind of a state of the state of where things are today. I'm happy to report that from last time we testified before your body, we have made some improvements in enterprise-wide security, but I think that it's important to recognize that we have some very significant problems enterprise-wide, and a considerable amount of work remains. It's really a case where the glass is really from 5 to 10% full now, but we have made some progress in this area. Some of the evidence that we have that supports that stance is we're still managing lots of security incidents out of our enterprise security office. We're still receiving subpar audits from the legislative auditor's office, and there's clearly an inconsistent application of critical security controls, basically stemming from the fact that we've kind of grown from an environment where we had siloed technology environments and there was varied states of readiness. The good news, though, is that of all the things that we're going to talk about today, I think one of the most important things that's happening is that agencies are, in fact, working together. We're going to talk about some of the detailed technology things that are actually happening, but I think the most important thing is that the agencies are, in fact, collaborating. People are sitting down at the table together, and that did not happen when I started as the Chief Information Security Officer a year and a half ago. We came from an environment where we had every agency doing its own thing. People weren't looking at ways that we could do this to accomplish our security goals as effectively and efficiently as possible, collectively as a body. So I'm really proud of the fact that we finally have people at the table and that we're working on strategic and tactical plans for enterprise security, which we hope to have out very soon. It may sound very fundamental to a legislative body, but our government has never had strategic plans. So we're starting by saying, if we do this right, what are the things that we absolutely need to see 5 years from now from a security perspective? And we've identified 18 core areas that we think we need to be good at 5 years down the road. We're also working on tactical plans to prioritize those things and decide what needs to be done first, what needs to be done during the next biennium. But basically, we are working together to formalize the plan collectively as a body, and I think that's very significant. Along with doing the planning type of work, we also have quite a few enterprise security solutions that are under development right now. So we, even though the full planning process isn't done and the plans aren't, we have identified some things that we definitely think are the top priorities, and work is already being done to address some of the top priority issues that we have and tactical things that are coming across our plate on a day-to-day basis. So looking at the top priorities that we have right now, on page 8, slide 15, the top two priorities on the list are really in the domain of things that we need to do to prevent and detect bad things from happening to our government. The third bullet on the list really relates to the corrective type of controls. What do we do if the sky falls in? How do we recover the operations? So first of all, the top priority on our list clearly is figuring out how are we going to address the barrage of complex security vulnerabilities that face us on a day-to-day basis. At the last hearing, I testified that during the last year that stats were available, I believe that we had around 8,000 new vulnerabilities that were pointed out by the U.S. CERT. And by the term vulnerabilities, typically these are flaws found in commercial software that if exploited by unscrupulous individuals, they can allow people to gain complete and unfettered access to government computer systems. So when you break it down by day, 8,000 flaws means that there's lots of different stuff that we need to address on a day-to-day basis. The challenge that we face as government when we have collectively across the executive branch and our higher ed institution, MinSCU, we estimate that we have about 150,000 endpoints that we need to manage. And any one of those endpoints and any software that runs on those endpoints, if a flaw is found in one of those software products, we need to be able to identify that flaw and we need to fix it as fast as we possibly can, because we know that people will be looking to exploit that vulnerability. In the past, we talked about having a certain period of time to fix things. Now the trend in the security world is that as soon as something is identified as a flaw, there's already exploits in the wild that are trying to take advantage of that exploit. So vulnerability and threat management is one of our top priorities. We've worked on speccing out a system government-wide, and that system is now out in production. It's being piloted in 5 major government agencies, and it ultimately will be rolled out across the entire government and across MNSCU as well. MNSCU has been a very strong partner with us in order to put these solutions in. But at the present time, we are now actively scanning over 5,000 devices in our pilot agencies. We're also scanning the external face of government as well. We're trying to see the things that the hackers would see most, and we're trying to alleviate any or to mitigate any weaknesses that we find in those devices. In addition, in that area, one of the things that's very critical for us is that we have very, very poor visibility of what's going on in the government computer networks. And if you think about this in terms of your own body, we have to get to a point as a government when something wrong is going on in an environment, we have to have our own processes to see that, in fact, there's a problem going on and that we need to quarantine that area and we need to do something about it as soon as possible to prevent that same problem from happening in other areas. We're certainly not there yet. We do not have any enterprise-wide monitoring capabilities. There are some agencies that have their own solutions in place, but by and large, this is an area that's not addressed very well for government, but this is the second priority on our priority list. And we have a cross-agency team that's actually working on a business case trying to answer the question, for something as large as a government, how do we address this problem so that we can solve the problem and we can do it as cost-effectively as possible for the entire government? Moving down the list, we're also actively working on ways to streamline and strengthen access controls across government. And then finally, we're working on ways to position government so it's in a better position to continue operations during times of crisis. This is actually an area that you'll be reading more about in the upcoming weeks. The legislative auditor is doing an audit of continuity of operations government-wide. The question that they're trying to answer is, if there is a crisis that impacts technology, a major technology-related crisis, does government have the ability to recover from that crisis and keep its mission-critical systems up and running? We've testified in front of this committee before that in fact, there are many mission-critical services that will not be up and running on a timely basis. We've also deductively pointed out these things at some of the enterprise security briefings. So the legislative audit will be coming out in a couple weeks, and you can expect to see those type of answers when the legislative auditor releases its report. Some of the other accomplishments that we've addressed during the last year are we worked very hard on some of the tactical things. We've worked on designing secure email processes for government. Basically, the premise is we wanted to get government in a state where if one agency sends email to another agency, that the channel between all the individual email servers that we're running right now are encrypted so that we can have secure communication with email. We've worked on improving portable computing device security, putting in place policies and standards, and also figuring out technology solutions so that when government laptops or thumb drives or their devices are lost or stolen, that people can't get the data off those devices because we have robust encryption solutions in place. We've done a significant amount of training, both on technology solutions that we're operating internally as part of the security program. For example, with the encryption product, we've trained over 100 technology professionals across government on how to manage and roll out that product throughout their environment. But we've also done quite a bit of broader-based training as well to improve the overall competency of security professionals across government. I believe that we now have about 40 to 50 new certified information system security professionals in government because we've been using part of our money to provide broader-based training for professionals throughout government. As I mentioned earlier, we are actively managing many security incidents, working on behalf of individual agencies who need help with forensic work in these areas, trying to recover their systems from states after they've been exploited. We're also working with a lot of development teams that are building new government computer systems, trying to make sure that they understand the security controls that need to be baked into new computer systems as we build them. I think that's really important. A lot of the problems that we're seeing today are primarily caused because when the systems were designed, we didn't build the security controls into the systems up front. So we clearly need to go a lot further in this area and really get a robust certification and accreditation program in place where it's more formalized. But as we roll out that certification and accreditation process, we are working on the teams now so that when we're building new systems like MAPS and the big computer systems across government, that we can help those people as much as we possibly can to do things right the first time. And then finally, we're providing assistance to a lot of state agencies that don't have a lot of security expertise in their environment. So to the extent of our capabilities, with the resources that you provided, you should hear different government agencies, if you ask them the question, we've been out in their areas, and we've been trying to give them as much help as we possibly can, and there is just an incredible backlog of need in this area. We have so many people that are knocking on our door, can you please come out and help us with this? And right now, we have a backlog of people who we can actually work with in this particular area.
Mr. Chair?
And I should add, I requested your assistance over the past summer and fall, and as well as Mr. Lally's, to help identify Senate technology needs and security issues and so forth. And although we do already have our Senate information systems, I wanted to draw upon their expertise as well so we could get a couple of set of eyes looking at this. And I appreciate the help that OET gave to us, too. Sarah Olsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this could be to any one of you guys. Hearing, the money crunch, where's the equipment going to come from, and you guys are overtaxed. I was kind of looking at this flow chart, and you guys answered to the governor, and where's he on all this stuff?
Mr. Chair.
What way do you mean, Sir Olson?
Well,
what do you mean?
I'm wondering where, because we've heard earlier this week, we also heard, about money for funding for replacing computers and all this stuff, and it just seems like we're really kind of just doing a Band-Aid approach to a system that's broken. And I'm thinking that, according to the chart, he's right above right there, and I'm just wondering what his plan is to address all these things we've been talking about.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olsen, I think you're looking at our organization chart.
Yeah. Yes.
And every agency has an organization chart. It will be similar looking in the executive branch. The governor has indeed put forth a very powerful vision before us to transform government operations because the governor sincerely believes that we need to prepare to serve the iPod generation, as he calls it, because if you look at the Gen X, Gen Y, and even the baby boomers who are technology-enabled, and as technology has proliferated and become part of our day-to-day life in businesses and personal endeavors, we need to do a lot of work. The government systems were designed 20, 30 years ago, before internet was even conceived. A lot of technologies have emerged over the last 5 to 10 years that were not even in play 15, 20 years ago. So what we have before us, literally a multi-year challenge to transform government operations from where we are. Our systems were developed in the last century. They were fashioned around the corporate model of brick and mortar model that you process the paper and went through a flow. In the digital age, those systems will not work. So to make our government more effective and efficient in the 21st century, we have to make an investment going forward. Our endeavor is, we see it as a very long period of endeavor of transformation and change. So I could not be more grateful than I am to the governor because he set the tone and has challenged us to look at solutions and opportunities and define them and come up with a plan. I'm also grateful to the legislature. You all have been very sympathetic and appreciative of our work, and I'm really grateful.
Mr. Chair, follow up. Thank you. And I appreciate that, but being grateful doesn't really get the job done. I mean, I understand everything you're saying, that we're in a new technology and people want to access state stuff from home and all of those things, but I'm just concerned about how in the world are we going to pay for all this stuff.
Mr. Lally?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olsen, I think one thing I hope we've emphasized is the need for planning. there's more than just spending on any aspect of technology. What we have to do is put it in the context of managing the entire portfolio that we have, one major element of which is security. Before Chris came on board, there was no plan for information security. Now they've developed a strategic plan around that. So regardless of what level of resources is made available, and we're not naive, we know there are competing demands for the resources that are available within the state, we could try to address the most important issues, the highest profile issues, the foundational issues first. So if it takes us 5 years to get where we'd like to be tomorrow, that's a reality. But at least what we do is investing rather than just spending. And that's why so much of the effort the last year has been on creating that plan, getting the agencies on board, so that whatever we do, we're leveraging those resources to the maximum amount possible. Is it enough? No. There's no way that we're putting enough money into security and business continuation. But whatever amount we get, we're going to do the best job we can with. And that's because we're trying to put it in so it's in sync always with what's going to get us there the soonest.
A last follow-up?
Sure.
Thank you. I'm pretty interested in the lease purchase type of an option to finance these things. I can see where the bonding, I think your points were well taken. Who's going to give you a bond for something that may have a life cycle of 5 years, although you've been telling us some of your machines are 30 years old. But could you address a little bit more on the lease?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olsen, the principle behind leasing software, and we're not talking about boxes, we're not talking about computers, we're talking about application software. The idea is that you lease a product, an off-the-shelf product normally, and pay for it over its life cycle, recognizing your cost of capital is going to be higher, that you're creating an obligation to pay down the road. And like with the bond market, there's the possibility that the program will change so dramatically that your program will no longer be useful, but you're still obligated to pay for it. Lease purchase, or lease without purchase, just leasing, is a good way to get standard software, major application software that you're not going to modify and that has a reasonable life cycle put into place. For security, I'm not sure that leasing would be the most effective way to put that into place because you don't want to have to change that out routinely. You want to create this seamless is probably too strong a word, but well-coordinated environment where the different components of your security architecture work together. But leasing is a way to get software with some statutory changes into the enterprise and defer the costs out into the future. But the costs are still there. They don't go away.
Thank you. Why not look at leasing hardware?
Sorry.
Why not look at leasing hardware? Or isn't that available?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olsen, we do lease hardware now. We defer the cost over the predicted life cycle of the hardware. Software, statutorily and by process within the Department of Finance, has limitations on how much of that package can be in software because of the transient nature of software. So there, right now we can get you the information. I don't remember off the top of my head, but no more than 20% of the total package for hardware can be tied up with the software that runs on that hardware. That's whether you're talking about a mainframe or a server or whatever. When you get down to desktop machines, the life cycle on a machine is typically now, they're getting much more reliable, is typically around 42 months. 3.5 years is the effective life cycle. You start to have more repair costs and update costs than the value of the machine at the end of that period. That's on the edge for what you want to lease with hardware. You typically are going to do it for the bigger stuff, the big iron, where your life cycle on that box is going to be long enough that doing a lease over a 5 or 6 year period makes sense. With software, the software that runs on it, that is not, you have to have an operating system on your laptop to make it work, for example. So it wouldn't make sense to buy the laptop unless you've got an operating system disk to put on it. You need the package, and that's why the leasing can incorporate the software. But if we're taking a major applications, revenue is coming on as soon as we get away from the table to describe what they're doing. That application is highly customized to their environment. It may not be as much as if it were custom developed, but it still suits their environment. to lease that is going to be extraordinarily expensive if you have to then continually renew that lease for an operating system that'll probably have a 15 or 20 years. It just gets way too expensive to continue that lease modification going out.
Thanks.
Okay. Sarah Loomer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is it Busey?
Yes.
Mr. Busey, my concern has been one that's been kind of a lengthy one over the years. I've heard, especially in the Department of Motor Vehicle Records, that they had made promises that we could, that they could control the security of their data. And in the past few years, we've had legislative audit reports as well as news stories that have shown that they had some major gaps in that security a few years ago. And whenever we start collecting data, and government's been doing it for years, but the advent of a computer age is now means that it can be portable, it can be transported via telephone lines, doesn't even have to have wire, it's wireless computer lines now. And my concern is how can we ever be assured that there's absolute security for our citizens in collecting data, maybe housing them in a single repository, and then at the same time wondering if there's any redundancy plans for security or in a changing technology. Isn't that a running game that you have to stay ahead of what the market can access, and that we have to how you haven't addressed that, I don't think, today. Could you maybe tiptoe into that area for
Mr. Busey, is there such a thing as absolute security in this business?
Mr. Chair, committee members, the answer, this is one answer that's very easy for me. There is no way for us to be absolutely secure. Everything that we're doing in the security world is all about risk management. It's very much like when you buy insurance. And our challenge is to balance the amount of security that we want to buy to protect the assets we have against the cost of that. So it's very much a cost-benefit decision. The overall message that I'm telling you through this testimony today and through other testimony that I've presented is that we haven't stricken the right balance yet. And we're paying for a lot of decisions that we've made in the past that weren't necessarily good decisions. So we're trying to remedy a lot of the problems that are out there, and we're working hard to try and make sure that we don't further exacerbate the problems as we develop new computer systems today. But we ultimately will never be completely secure. It's very much a cat and mouse game. And as we go and we try and figure out what controls are going to be. You think about the example that you just read about, you know, we've worked very hard to instill laptop encryption to protect our devices, but everybody read in the news now that people figured out that you can freeze the chip in a computer with a can of spray, and there's ways that you can bypass that with a can of spray. And now it's our turn again to figure out what do we do about it as a security community. So it's an ongoing battle. It's a journey. It's a journey. There's no final destination to this. But it's all about risk management, and that's why that's so important for our program to have ongoing people that are trained so that we can work and anticipate the future and keep our government on top of the risks as we go along.
Mr. Chair, sometimes a physical barrier or a physical redundancy may be necessary. I know that we, with the advent of computers, we like to, they're portable, you can take things home. You hear in the news all the time of somebody who has misplaced or had their laptop stolen out of their car. And for the purposes of a state government record file, I find it hard to believe that there's any need to have anyone bring a laptop that carries that much information home anyway, or a disk for that matter, for official work. If they can't get the work done at the office, I guess I'm wondering maybe there's some contract doors who would like to bring that home and or bring it to their home office and work on it there. But I'm just wondering, is that a proper secure barrier just to keep it inside a building or not?
Mr. Chair, committee members, the answer to that question has already been addressed within our state policy framework. In our portable computing devices policy, the first cut that we take is that not public data should not be housed on portable computing devices at all unless there is a justifiable business need to do so. And there are justifiable business reasons why it has to happen when you look at the vast type of things that state government does, where we have, you know, tax collectors that have to go out in the field to some remote place where they can't get internet access. There's a lot of different reasons why it has to happen. But when those cases happen, then we have the policy that says in that those devices that data is on have to have that encryption that we think is important, because if that device is lost or stolen, then we don't care necessarily about the device being lost. I mean, yeah, it's an inconvenience to us, but we don't want people getting the data. So the first cut is don't do it unless you have to, but if you do, make sure you use the robust encryption. But that's exactly how the policy states today.
Mr. Chair, the other area, and I don't know how you'd combat against this, but there's also that possibility that there just may be a person in a weak moment that might have an opportunity to sell it. And we all think of our employees as being pure as the driven snow, but we all know the vagaries of temptation. And that may be a list of a million names to some offshore facility that needs that has been in existence for, 6, 8, 10 years, can certainly use that for a profit motive and basically just buy it from that individual after it's decrypted. And do we have consequences in law in the event that our state employees may do that through a what I would call, for lack of a better term, an illegal sale of information? Have we ever addressed that?
Beyond state employees, too, Senator Lerner. For instance, law enforcement has access to the driver's license database. So it's beyond just state employees. But what are the consequences for, unauthorized access and distribution of the databases that we have?
Mr. Chair, committee members, if acceptable to you, I don't know the precise answer to that. Okay. I know that there are consequences, but I don't know specifically what they are, but I can get back to you with that answer.
Okay.
In general, the term that you're describing in the industry is called data leakage, and people look at controls to prevent data leakage. In our particular case in state government, if we get to the point where we're talking about putting in controls for data leakage from the point where we are today, I will consider us very, very successful. We have a lot of bigger fish to fry than that one at this point.
Okay, Mr. Boozy, could you proceed?
To finish up with my portion of the presentation, if we look at the challenges, obviously, as we talked about earlier, we definitely have some serious resource issues with the Enterprise Security Program. Currently, in this biennium, our funding is set at a certain amount, but going on in future bienniums, our base appropriation goes down by about 30% from this year to the next biennium. And one of the challenges we face is that, as Mr. Lally indicated in his testimony, that the ongoing cost of putting in systems is fairly substantial. In the case of our vulnerability and threat management system that we're putting in today, about 30% of the purchase price of the system needs to be spent every year just for the people, the ongoing licensing costs, and the operating costs that you need to run the system. So the base appropriation going down definitely has some significant impact for us, because we have to be able to pay long-term for the decisions that we make today when we put in the security controls. There's heavy tails in most of these things because they rely on a lot of people to run them. We've also had some challenges with just government. Government itself has had difficulty at this point figuring out what's the process to create process. As we're moving from an environment where we had all different silos in our technology world to a point where we're trying to make enterprise-wide decisions, there really wasn't structure in place to figure out how do we make enterprise-wide decisions. We're coming very close to solving those problems, but those are things that we definitely have to struggle through to get to the point where we build and deploy systems that interact with a lot of different government agencies. Clearly, the complexity of our current technology environment is a battle that we face. We have approximately 70 data centers. In fact, when I left my former job working for Legislative Auditor Jim Nobles, one of the final hearings that I testified at was when Senator Rest was the chair of the Audit Commission, and she said, we have all these bad audits, and we had just released the audit of the motor vehicle system. And she goes, can you just roll this up to me and tell me, what does this all mean? And one quote that we told her is that one of the biggest problems that we have is that we run everything everywhere without sufficient planning or leadership. And that's one of the problems that you have. If you think of this security as a war, in a sense, the more battlefronts we have with the more diversity, the harder it is to solve the problems and to become secure. So the complexity of our environment is a challenge that we face today. And hopefully, as we try to standardize a lot of our technology, we'll have more success at trying to put in security solutions. Some final thoughts then for today is that clearly there's a significant gap between where we are and where we need to be. But the good news is that OET and all the agencies are now working hand in hand to bridge the gap and solve the problems that are out there. And I think that's really important for us. But also that your committee and all policymakers, I thought today, have been pretty good at trying to help support our program, and continued help from the legislature will be vital to our long-term success for enterprise security. So I'd like to thank you once again for all the support.
Okay, any other questions on this issue before we move on?
Okay. Don? Mr. Chairman, members, you asked for an update on the e-licensing project. If I could just refresh your memories, last year you gave us $7.5 million towards the estimated $35 million cost of this system. This is one of the first of the systems we're looking at statewide, looking at managing the portfolio centrally, where we'll have a common functionality that will serve the scores of agencies and hundreds of licenses that are issued with a common core of technology upon which they can build for the particular extensions they need for their license type. Last year, we mentioned we would have to put in place a foundation for this electronic licensing system, and that's what our efforts have been on this past year, to create the infrastructure portal, if you will, to allow people to apply for and get their licenses over the web, as opposed to coming to us on our time or filling out paper to get licenses. The idea is that the initial system will be, the foundation will be created and the program logic put into place to allow a handful of licenses to be implemented as a proof of concept, and then we will incrementally, in the next four phases of this project, bring other licenses into the fold. So they will share parts of the logic. This is not a one-size-fits-all solution. It is a one-foundation-supports-all solution, and we'll begin working on that right now. The second part of this is the development of the foundational logic for processing licenses. That contract is currently under negotiation. It was competitively bid, and I believe they're getting close to an award for the prime contractor to do much of that work for us, and then that will be built on in subsequent years as other licenses come on board. You've asked us to come back next legislative session with a comprehensive financial plan of how we will create and support that overall environment. And one of the components supporting that was the funding study that we discussed earlier. So we can look at what is the best way to support that life cycle. Steve Sfigum, Commissioner of Labor and Industry, is the executive sponsor for this effort. There is a steering committee for many of the client agencies that are involved to ensure that their business interests are supported in it. And the rationale behind this is, with a common system, the amount of support that is necessary will be reduced. You could streamline the business processes in each agency and control the future costs of this, and in the process improve service. So we are a long ways from being done, but we are on target with creating that foundation and the process by the end of the summer, I believe, is to bring the first of those applications on board. Begin issuing licenses using them.
I do have a question, Mr. Lally. We don't know what the forecast is going to hold out and so forth, but we may be having to look at some areas where new startup programs, can they be pushed back or delayed or anything? How far are we along on e-licensing if we have to say, well, we need to, kind of hold, put in a holding pattern until we can get a handle on some of the other core functions that we're supposed to be doing. Where are we as far as?
The foundation is being created and will serve other purposes besides this. I'm always tempted to say, well, there's absolutely no way that we can stop the process, but in point of fact, you can. But you have to recognize that then the benefits of this, both increased service levels and greater efficiency in the agencies, also aren't delivered. So and as you do those kind of trade-off calculations in your analysis, we certainly hope that we can continue at least with these initial initial systems that are coming on and then do the planning around how we bring more systems to bear in there.
Well, we'll wait and see. What, Senator Jungbauer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to make you aware if we consider pulling the plug on that, make sure they have plenty of time, because in Minnesota this year we had a lot of licensed contractors out of business temporarily at the beginning of the year due to some already changed items within the Department of Labor Industry. They did not get their bonding thing ducks in a row, and people were waiting some as long as 6 weeks to get a license, and they couldn't operate their businesses without a license. So we want to make sure we don't create that kind of a nightmare scenario.
Sure.
Again,
well,
this,
you know, I mean, e-licensing is obviously a way to make it more convenient, and there are savings in it. But at some point, you know, we're going to have to look at the big picture and figure out, you know, should we, how far can we keep spending money to go into something new when we may not have any money to do even the basic functions. I mean, those are decisions that are going to have to be made at some point fairly soon. So,
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Lally.
Assistant Commissioner Reggie David, who's the head of our e-government practice within OET, just reminded me that we're very close to signing the contract on that, at which point we are at least obligated to do some of this work. So,
although most contracts could be terminated for the convenience of the government, I guess that's, you know, those provisions are always
out. You're outside my level of expertise in contract law, I'm afraid, sir.
Okay.
Anything next further? Thing you asked for an update on was the Small Agency Assistance Program. And again, to refresh your memories, you gave us some money to help a handful of the smaller agencies, and also we created a process to try to support a number of other small agencies that were involved in that. And before we talk a little bit about the status of this, I'd like to talk about what we've learned through this process. It's been a slow process. Part of the difficulty we have is many of the small agencies don't have professional IT staff. They don't need them routinely, and they can't afford them even if they need them. But this means that when we get into the process of working with them to help meet their technology needs, in most cases they don't have a plan. They can't identify the user requirements. They don't have their business functions documented. So we go through a fairly labor-intensive process working with those agencies to get them in shape so that when they get involved with the procurement of software or hardware or services, that they're the right services and that the price is right. And that's what we've been doing for most of the last year with these small agencies. I have to tell you, and I know this will not make all of them sorry, our clear conclusion is there has to be a better way of having these individual small boards and councils dependent upon their own resources. They cannot maintain a secure computing environment. They cannot maintain a reliable computer environment with a secretary working part-time to maintain their computers, and that's what many of them have. I think Mr. Busey will tell you that some of the most glaring vulnerabilities within our systems come with these small agencies because they don't have the wherewithal or the knowledge to support the infrastructure protection that they need. And so anything we can do to try to encourage a more systematic approach to how they do information technology would be definitely in order. We've been doing this with several part-time analysts working with them as time was available, and we've made significant progress in a couple of the agencies, but there's a lot more work that needs to be done along this way. And while we've bailed out, use that word advisedly, it bailed out some of these organizations for their short-term problems, we aren't addressing their long-term. That's just the reality of it. Our process was to not buy what they said they wanted, but to find out what they need. and then to help them make the procurement that's consistent with that. And that has been frustrating for them, because when we start talking about business requirements and doing a systems plan and things like that, in most cases, it's talking foreign language to them. They're not technical people. But it's really important that we do that so that we are buying consistent with the architecture and with the needs to keep the infrastructure stable once they're on board with that. That said, we currently have projects using the small agency methodology. Human Rights was establishing a new case management system. Minnesota Racing Commission, we're working with them on the MRC information system integration. With the new racetrack that's coming in, they're trying to simultaneously update and expand and improve the capacity of what they're doing. So we've been working with them on an ongoing basis to make sure this is done properly. The Asian Pacific Council, which is only one of a multitude of those small organizations that need some help. Minnesota Veterans Home Board, our work was less with the technology and more with the information management capacity and helping them do some strategic planning around their information needs. Minnesota Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped, a lot of support systems and upgrades to their technology have been in the mix, and part of that is a matter of acquiring hardware and software, and part of it is a matter of integration. State academies, voice over IP, internet-based telephony, classroom updates for the, especially for adaptive learning technologies. We're working with them actively, and many of the purchase orders have gone out for their hardware and software acquisition. The CAP board is trying to take a website that is very much outdated and make it more functional and useful to their customers. And that process is well underway. The Ombudsman for Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities, they had an old case management system that was in trouble, and we've been working with them to try to define the system requirements and then come up with a newer, upgraded case management system. And some of those projects will be done in the next few weeks. Others will carry on to the end of the fiscal year or into next fiscal year. It's been, I think, a learning experience for those organizations, and certainly an eye-opener for those of us who primarily were used to dealing with large organizations with professional systems staff. The needs out there are significant.
I think I know we looked at all those last year and approved the funding for their IT upgrades. Were there any other agencies that are still out there that still need to be addressed?
Mr. Chairman, there are a lot of agencies who don't know what they don't know.
Okay.
I mean, I don't know how else to put it. There are significant needs out there that they don't understand. If they came forward, they might talk about buying new computers when what they need are a whole new approach to the application support. We've tried to advance, and I've used that phrase before today, portfolio management, which is looking at the business processes and the system needs across the enterprise. For example, two of these projects involve case management systems. We think that's one of the technologies, along with electronic document management and identity management, where enterprise solution can be the basis for serving many agencies' needs. But as long as we continue to see those requests come forward incrementally on a silo basis, the opportunity to come up with a solution that will benefit many of them with higher reliability and lower cost is compromised. So right now we get, when they come up with a systems request, we have an opportunity to review it in most cases. But it's hard to put that together with other small organizations that have those needs that haven't articulated them. So this is a problem. And again, because often their security is among the weakest, there are some real issues of urgency that we have to address some of those.
Okay, and I guess wrapping it up on telecommunications.
The information and telecommunications account was created, and you received a report, I believe, this fall in November, perhaps, summarizing the activity in that. It's an account that is used to accumulate agency contributions. Basically, they fit into two categories. Either they are for enterprise solutions, so multiple agencies can pool limited resources and come up with a solution that will serve all of them, or where they have a cost associated with an enterprise solution that they can put some money aside to invest in making that solution work for them. The funds are committed to a specific project. It's not a slush fund that they can just dump money into and then spend it on anything they want to after the fact. So there has to be a plan. It has to be approved by the governing process, and the expenditures have to be focused on the projects that have been approved. This is one portion when we talk about an enterprise technology investment fund, one concept that we think is important to allow for a planful approach to replacement of systems or creation of systems, irrespective of the budget cycle or the calendar. This is a prudent way. Most businesses would start to put money away in advance of a major expenditure like this. And this is just one example of how they're trying to do that in this fund. The governing teams for each project are cross-agency. It's overall supervised by OET's financial management and then with the assistance of the Department of Finance.
Okay. Any questions? Before you wrap up, I do have another question. The governor has a hiring freeze, I guess, for lack of a better term. How is that going to affect OET's immediate future?
Mr. Chairman, in a couple ways. Obviously, if you look at me, we have an aging workforce that is nearing retirement, and so eventually that will play out. But in the short term, the reality is we don't have the resources to hire the people if the hiring restrictions were not in place. So many of the positions that we have that are vacant remain vacant because we can't afford to fill them. So I think the practical impact of it is probably less than the theoretical impact.
Well, if I could just back up here on the telecommunications, there's a one-page summary. Are these... This is not a particular priority, is it? It's just how you've been funding.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, I don't have a copy of the report.
Oh, this is the information telecommunications account. The last page just lists a number of projects, and I was just wondering if that's...
No, it is just a list.
Okay.
There's no prioritization implied. What it lets you see is that these are all either enterprise-wide or cross-agency projects. They're not, for the most part, single-agency projects.
Okay. Obviously, you've already expended some money to date on some and not on others. The ones you have not expended any money on, is that because you're still working out the details? Or?
Mr. Chairman, this particular report is dated.
From October,
an updated
right, yeah.
One, but there's been substantially more than this expended to date.
Okay. We may, if it's available, you know, this is October 31st, if something's available that, you know, shows us some more up-to-date numbers, I think we need to appreciate getting some.
Sure, of course.
Okay. Any further questions from OET? If not, thank you, Mr. Khanna.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. We appreciate being here, and thank you for your support.
Well, thank you. And next we'll hear from the Department of Revenue on the integrated tax system, which we funded last year, and then an update on tax compliance, which was also a funding issue that we dealt with last year. Commissioner, welcome back to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dan Salamone. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Revenue. Appreciate the opportunity to come here today to report to you on the integrated tax system, for which I know this committee and you in particular, Mr. Chair, have been very supportive. And without that support, we would still be here trying to sell you on the idea of an integrated tax system. We also... appreciate the opportunity to update you on the compliance initiatives. There are two handouts that I had distributed. One is a copy of some slides. There's a little flyer that is a nice summary of the highlights of the integrated tax system.
Okay. The handout's being distributed right now.
Mr. Chair, I should also, while he's here, thank our state CIO, Gopal Khanna, for his helping us help in getting this project off the ground. He's been very helpful to us. His folks have been partnering with us from the beginning on this integrated tax system, and so we are very appreciative of the efforts of OET on our behalf. If you have a copy of the handout, I think we can perhaps save some time by not going over all the arguments for an integrated tax system. There are some slides at the beginning of the presentation that remind you that we're trying to solve a problem with the integrated tax system. And the problem is that we've had over the years, we've created a fairly piecemeal approach to tax processing and tax systems that over the years have become antiquated and in many cases on the verge of collapse. And it was time to replace all of that with a more modern system.
Are we still using the 1968 COBOL system?
Mr. Chair, we may still have that. Okay. Certainly one that we're anxious to get rid of in 38-year-old software.
40 years old now. So, okay, whatever. Okay.
So I won't spend a lot of time on the case for the integrated tax system. Obviously, we have had to deal with the aging infrastructure that was becoming more vulnerable by the day. We have numerous mission-critical systems that need to be replaced in the next 5 years, and so you either invest a lot of money in the old system and get no new functionality and not be able to move the ball in terms of taxpayer services and so on, or you junk it all and build a new system, which is the approach that we have taken, and we're very, very excited about it. Currently under our systems, we have difficulty with employees when they move from one division to another having to learn entirely new systems. We lack the information and analytical tools we need to be more effective even in tax compliance because of our current systems. If you look on page 3, the top of page 3, there's a slide that I don't expect you to be able to read, and if you can read it, I'd be very jealous of you, your eyesight. But it's meant to give you sort of an impression of what our current systems look like. It's a diagram of various processes, not tax types, but processes, that show you sort of how complicated it all is. Many of those systems were built individually and as separate systems with a lot of difficult interfaces. So currently, when a taxpayer calls the Department of Revenue and they want information about their taxes or their tax account, our people may have to go in and out of several databases to get an answer to that taxpayer. And the answer may not be as accurate as we would like it to be given the kind of system we have right now. If you look at that top diagram on page 3, everything in that shaded gray area is going to be reconfigured with a new integrated tax system, which has just started, in fact, on Monday. There may be other pieces of that will be part of the retooling of the tax system. So we're going to replace the diagram on the top of that page to what you see at the bottom, which is more of a linear, more unified system where processes are identical for every tax type instead of being customized for every tax type. It's going to be a tremendous step forward for us on many fronts, not the least of which will be taxpayer service and tax compliance. On page 4, the benefits of the tax system, you just can sort of change the signs, if you will. All the negatives become positives. We'll have consolidated common functions across all taxes. That includes accounting, collections, reporting functions, more accurate and timely information, elimination of costly and very complex legacy systems, and better data for management decisions. We've had a legislative audit report that concluded that we needed to do a better job of using management data for our management decisions, better data from our tax system. And we will have better data with the integrated tax system. I mentioned taxpayer services. We are very excited about the possibilities for better and more service with a new system, as well as, to, as I said earlier, to be more efficient in our tax compliance initiatives. If you'll turn to page 5, I tried to summarize for you where we are with the funding of this project. I mentioned it is underway. Contractor staff were on site for the first time on Monday as part of this project. We were the total project cost, as when we came to the legislature last year, we showed it as $39.4 million. You can deduct from that monies that we will be able to redirect from our base budget by virtue of not having to rebuild or shore up the existing system that we have. That's $10.5 million. So that brings the total down to 28.9. We did get an appropriation from the legislature last year for $12 million. So you can subtract that off, and now we're down to $16.9 million of funding, against which we have already applied $450,000 from our carry forward money. This is the so-called 200 fund. So the amount of money that is yet to be funded, the cost yet to be funded, is $16.45 million, Mr. Chair. And we do are talking about bringing that request to the 09 legislative session.
Right.
And we'll pray for a better forecast and a better economy between now and then.
But so last year's appropriation, you anticipate, will carry you into 09, right?
Mr. Chair, no. Well, it'll take us.
I mean, it'll take it 09.
I mean, current by any.
Yeah. Okay. So we're.
We'll be coming back for 10 and 11.
We don't need to do anything this year on that.
Correct.
Gotcha. Okay.
The next slide with the tiny letters is a picture of our project structure. We spent a considerable amount of time thinking through how to organize this project so that we have a maximum probability of success. We have an oversight committee consisting of our upper management of the department. That committee will make the tough calls if our directors have disagreements about the items in the project. You see off to the left, an executive liaison person from the vendor. We'll have one of the top vendor people up there with us making some of those high-level decisions. Between the top and bottom box, you'll see a box saying executive project liaison. That person will sort of provide the glue between upper management and sort of the area where the real decisions get made on a day-to-day basis. The pink boxes are all of our will be staffed by all of our directors, and they're going to make most of the project, the difficult project decisions, which tax type we should start with, and various other decisions that are sure to come up over the course of the project. Below them, you see the more detailed worker-type activities. We have a business analyst of different types. We have subject matter experts. These are revenue department employees. You'll see in the yellow box, we have a business project manager. Her name is Vicki Dickinson, who comes from our withholding division. And we have a technical project advisor, Gary Molesky, who is here today with us. So I'm going to be counting on him for any technical questions, or your technical questions today. You'll see off to the right on the bottom, there is a vendor project manager, Mr. Jim Gocher, who is already on board. And there are right now about five vendor employees on site, and that will vary over the year, averaging about 16 people at a time. People are coming to Minnesota. They're purchasing or renting housing here and will be here for the duration of the project. So we're very happy with that arrangement. Getting a little ahead of the game, if you go to the next page, I should give you a little more on where we're at in terms of the project. As I said earlier, this has been a priority project for the department and for OET. It was supported by the Department of Finance. The key requirement we had going into the project was we did not want to have a customized job. We wanted to buy something, sort of a commercial off-the-shelf package that we could install, configure to our systems and processes, and then buy updates of the software from year to year. And that was a key requirement of our contract bid, our request for proposals. A competitive contract was let on August 6th of 1907. And after a period of time and analysis and so on, we did settle on the selection of Fast Enterprises based on cost, experience, and the nature of their product. Their product is called Gentax, and it is a true commercial off-the-shelf product. So they're already here on site beginning to install various modules of this, in a sense, canned software. But it's designed for tax processing and tax administration. This particular vendor has a number of former tax executives and tax administrators as part of their project team. So we have a high degree of confidence that we have selected a good vendor who will come in on time and under budget, on or under budget. Contract was signed on February 21st of this year, and as I said earlier, on Monday the 25th, project staff showed up, contract staff, and we're now in the process of planning the first phase of that project. That planning stage will be about 60 days, where we will decide things like which taxes are we going to do first, how are we going to make certain other decisions. There will be, over the course of the project, about four rollouts. Rollouts are chunks of taxes, lists of different taxes that will go through the process of installation on Gentax. And hopefully we'll be 4 years from now, Mr. Chair, we'll have a completely installed and operating tax processing system, one that will be just tremendously better than anything we've had in revenue for a long, long time. You see at the bottom of the chart the four rollouts and their rough the approximate time we expect to be in each of those four rollouts beyond the planning session. With that, Mr. Chair, I think that's a very high-level description of where we're at. I maybe would pause at this moment for any questions.
Are there any questions about the integrated tax system? First, we none.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The other thing you had asked for was an update on our compliance initiatives for the current biennium, fiscal year 08 and 09. If you'll see on page 7 at the bottom of the page is a summary of our current compliance initiative. It's highlighted in yellow. And to remind you, we were given $20.5 million by the last legislative session to return $102.4 million in additional compliance revenue. That's a return of 5 to 1. Currently, if you look over a few columns, the revenue collected to date, and to date here means 12/31/07, we've collected $23.2 million in new compliance revenue with the expenditure of $3.1 million of the 20.5 that we were given. So at this point in time, our rate of return, if you will, is 7.4 to 1. But I have to hasten to add, I hope you'll read the footnote, this early stage return on investment we expect to fall over the course of the project to the 5 to 1 that we had that we were given. I will also remind you that this legislative compliance initiative was probably one of our biggest in terms of the challenge. The size of this initiative is about 2 times what the governor had recommended. Time of when this was raised to the larger amount, we expressed some concerns about our ability to bring the money in on target. We're hopeful we can do that, but there's an unusual amount of risk associated with this particular compliance initiative. I should have also mentioned there is the history of the previous compliance initiative, so history of what we've done in the past, and you will see that while the ROI has been fairly strong, it has been declining. And nobody knows, certainly we don't, where we would ultimately reach the point of having a negative ROI, if you will, or at least get to 1 to 1. We don't have enough information to be able to predict when that would happen. So we have to sort of do this incrementally and be careful to not overcommit.
And I suppose that's because, first of all, you've already gotten the low-hanging fruit, the easier taxes to collect. It's getting harder and harder. Some is just simply never going to be collectible. And, you know, we're proceeding towards that. And I guess it also takes – you got to hire a lot of people to do this, and there's a limit to the number of people you can hire, which I guess seems to be coming
That's
up.
A major issue, Mr. Chair, the hiring and training of, in the most recent case, 136 new employees. Yeah, it's very challenging. It's very time-consuming. It doesn't happen overnight. And then when you have them, you hope you can retain them for a sufficiently long period of time to get to meet the target. We also now have we no longer have an empty building in the Stassen building where we are housed. We are now at capacity with the addition of the Office of Hearing Examiner. So we are now, with additional compliance initiatives, as with this one, we have to go out into the market and hire, buy or lease space. We've added to our office in Ely with this most recent compliance initiative. We have opened an office in Eagan, and some time ago we had opened an office in Edina. So if we do more compliance initiatives, and we certainly are not here to propose that or encourage that, but if it happens, we would have to go out and hire more space. And that's going to add to, or if you will, deduct from, the rate of return that we would predict. We do have continued turnover in our accounting positions, in spite of having worked with Dewar to do a memo of understanding to get a little adjustment to be a little closer to the market. Accountants are in great demand in the private sector, and we have a hard time keeping those we hire. The memo of understanding has helped to move the point at which they leave the department to be a little later instead of the year or two we maybe have now for 3 or 4 years. But that continues to be a problem. And I mentioned with the integrated tax system, a lot of our own employees are going to be distracted to some extent working with the integrated tax system. During the course of the project, some 100 employees of ours will have some interaction with the integrated tax system, depending on which tax we do and when theirs happens to come up. So that has got to be a little bit of a worry in terms of what we can do in the future with integrated with the compliance initiatives.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Robley.
As we go through a recession, do tax revenues and collections typically fall? What has been the historic pattern for that? And what happens when businesses or individuals file bankruptcy and owe large debts? Do those stay on their books forever, or are those forgiven in or reduced in bankruptcy proceedings?
I don't think taxes are dischargeable in bankruptcy. Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, I was going to say that the department is not in the business of forgiving taxes too often. It's not something with companies that get into trouble at a time of recession, we certainly would encourage them to do what they can, and we will try to work with them to keep them in compliance with the tax laws. Clearly, when we go into a recession, tax collections do fall off. That's clearly why we are all expecting a more negative forecast tomorrow. And collections also fall off. It's just more difficult to get people to settle up with us. And so we have to be as aggressive as we can, but we also have to have some compassion and a sort of a light touch, recognizing the times that we're in. I can't say that we change our techniques or methodologies for collecting taxes because it's a recession. But clearly we do expect to see more delinquencies during a recession.
And I don't know if there's any proposals now, but when I was on the tax committee, I remember there were some suggestions to have a tax amnesty period where people would pay their back taxes and then we would forgive them. And those proposals never really got very far, but, I don't know if anything's in play now. So.
Mr. Chair, I'm not aware of any, and the department usually takes a dim view of tax amnesties.
That's why I didn't go anywhere. So.
They do seem to be inconsistent with tax compliance initiatives,
right.
And there's a lot of other things you could say about it, but we certainly are open to whatever the legislature might want to discuss about that.
Sure.
On page 8, there's a couple other charts that really show the same information that we had on page 7. You will note on the top of page 8 that during the last the previous compliance initiative, we exceeded our target by significant amounts, 62% in civil 2003, 54% 26. Now, at this point in time, we're at 23% of the goal, the revenue goal for our current compliance initiative, and we're about a quarter through the biennium. So the fact that the calendar is outpacing the revenue collections gives us a little worry, but we're just watching it closely. On the bottom, you'll see the history in the chart form of the ROI. You'll see the green line is the actual ROI, and the red line is the promised ROI. And there, again, you see that we have exceeded our expectations. The important thing on this chart is to note the end point of the green line, the actual ROI right now on the current initiative for 08-09 is 7.4. We had that on the previous chart. We expect that green dot to fall and become coincident with the 5.0 on the red line. That is, we do hope and expect to reach our 5-to-1 rate of return on the current initiative. But as I indicated, there are some risk factors there that were not there for the earlier initiatives. So we're a little bit nervous about it. We're doing our best. We think we'll make it. You'll flip to the last page, page 9. Quick update on collections, then. We are at $23.2 million under the current initiative as of December 31. $13.9 million of that was from identifying non-filers, increasing the number of audits for individuals and businesses. $9.3 million of it was from the collection of delinquent taxes. We've resolved 9,600 non-compliant income tax cases, 400 non-compliant sales tax cases, 316 corporate income tax cases. And I should mention on Friday, March 1st, you will receive a report on the 080, on the previous compliance initiative. So you'll have a lot more information in that report coming out this Friday. So we think we're on track to collect $102.4 million. And as I said, because of the greater degree of risk associated with this particular initiative, we do have some concerns. But we'll keep you posted as we move forward.
I've got one or two questions. Well, the hiring freeze, as I also asked OET, that might affect you in hiring seasonal employees, tax compliance officers. Do you see an impact upon Department of Revenue?
Mr. Chair, as I read the directive from the governor's office, it was a restriction on hiring. So there was a recognition that there are certain functions that agencies have that are mission critical, and one of them was the administration. I can't remember the exact words. The protection of the integrity of the state's fiscal system. Based on that, we have whole classes of employees that would be exempted from the restrictions. They would include auditors, collectors. You mentioned seasonal employees, very specifically seasonal employees. We depend on a small army of seasonal employees who come in at the beginning of tax processing season, and they come in on a third shift usually and spend the night opening returns and dealing with mail and a number of processes, doing data entry and so on. Without those employees, we would see a significant drop in revenue collection simply because the process is not working. We need to get those tax returns open, money in the bank. So we did identify certain numbers of classes. I think there are about four or five that were, and this is with the blessing of the governor and the and Department of Employee Relations. We've sort of gotten blanket exemptions for those employees. So that leaves the employees who are in the more support and the HR communications. There are a number of other divisions and units that do not have a direct role in the collection and accounting of tax payments. Those will be that area of the department, which is about a third of the department, we'll have to look to for meeting the goals for reductions in FTE, as well as whatever budget cut may ultimately turn out to be mandated for all the agencies.
Do you have any sense, it's more of a tax committee question, but you know we have jurisdiction over the department. Do you have any sense if the 2007 tax filings, are they on track, are they behind, are you ahead, or you know how are people doing there?
I'm looking at my income tax, okay. my AC for income tax.
Yeah.
She says on track. So
okay.
Things look good at this point.
Okay. Any questions for the department? Sir Roebling.
Thank you. I realize that most people who file early are probably getting refunds. And I hear you're doing a very good job at getting those out very quickly, especially if they file electronically. I've heard from several people who are amazed at how fast the refunds came. But I was just wondering, as you get closer to April 15th, and a lot of people who are paying are waiting until then to pay, do you have enough of a reserve to continue to put those refunds out early without having the revenues that are due that are often the last ones to come in?
I think in the short term we do. The question really is a Department of Finance question more than a revenue department question. To the extent that we have budget reserves, we wouldn't expect not to be able to provide refunds. There's no reason. Now, obviously, we have a looming budget problem, and we're all going to have to deal with that. And you're right about, the payments come later than the refunds, obviously. And thank you for mentioning the fast refunds. We're very proud of that. The actual, if a taxpayer files electronically and gives us their routing numbers, that's a really key piece, then we're pretty comfortable 3 days that refund will be in their box. And so that's a tremendous improvement over past years when we didn't have electronic filing and couldn't do the kinds of things we do now. So we need to keep getting the word out to get more people to file electronically. And though are we number one or number two, Carol? She keeps saying we're number one among the states in terms of electronic filing. About 70% of our taxpayers are filing electronically, and that's amazing.
Sarah Roebling.
Thank you. I was just going to ask you about, it said that you had resolved 400 non-compliant sales and use tax cases. Are those people who often have collected the sales taxes and not remitted them? Or are they people who fail to charge sales tax in the first place?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think it's a mixture of both. And I don't know if we could shed any light on that. We'd probably have to do a little research to break it down.
Anything further? Well, I guess we'll see what happens tomorrow and watch the building shift on us. So. Okay. Thank you, Commissioner.
And thank you, Mr. Chair.
Nothing further. The meeting's adjourned. Thanks.
Their revenue forecast.
Oh,